This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Rendell Smith thought it was time to lose a few pounds, so he took up running. He didn't really consider his race when he made that decision, but he realized it was an issue when he was jogging down the street and a woman walking toward him dropped her groceries and fled in terror. It turns out that deeply held racial stereotypes have a big impact on the way African Americans choose to exercise. Rendell Smith wanted to change some of that. He created a new exercise group called Black Man Running. It's based in Wilmington, and it looks to shift how people view black men in public spaces. The group combines political conversations with exercise. And my guest today is Rendell Smith. He's the co-founder of Black Man Running and joins me from sister station WHQR in Wilmington. Rendell, welcome.
Thanks.
Good to talk with you. Also with you in Wilmington is the group's running coach, Martha Foy. Hello, Martha.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Rendell, talk a little bit about Black Man Running. First of all, what is it all about? What do you do?
Okay, so Black Man Running is a public art project, and it brings people together around racial justice while using running as a point of departure and an organizing tool. Okay. So we're essentially hacking the 5K run model to bring attention to and create art around racial profiling. So the way that starts out is, you know, since the dynamics of racial profiling play out in public space, we started out asking people, you know, if they planned out a run in their community, like where would they go? Where wouldn't they go? Would they take a friend? Would they take Mace? And that was a way into acknowledging sort of the personal restrictions that we sometimes face when moving through public space, the privileges and affordances, the invisible demarcations that we encounter in our communities, the power diagrams that we map by moving around it. So, you know, we talked to first folks about this external mapping, this sort of self-mapping as a way of exhuming all of this and as a way of sharing stories about, you know, what it's like to go on a run.
And it's interesting to see how you first came to this. I outlined a story in my introduction, but maybe you can give us the details. And I think this is about the first time that something like this actually came to your consciousness, was it?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I was definitely cognizant of the fact that there were certain racial politics out there. But, you know, I was 17. I was in Philadelphia. I was on my way to college. I was thinking about dropping a few pounds and decided that the best way to do that was to go out jogging, to go on a run. You know, and I'd seen this sort of archetypical running images over and over on television and sort of knew how to dress the part. So, you know, got the wristbands and threw a towel around my neck and, you know, got the right jogging pants and, you know, assumed that this kind of costume would allow me a safe passage through my neighborhood and the neighborhoods around me. So, you know, probably about six blocks out, I would say, I started getting different reactions in a predominantly white neighborhood. And that ultimately culminated in, you know, one woman just absolutely panicking at the sight of me running towards her and dropping her groceries and running in the other direction. Now, she only ran a few feet and kind of figured out what was going on and came back to her groceries and, you know, went about her routine. But it had certainly sort of taught me a lesson about how I would be perceived running as opposed to, you know, folks of various other backgrounds.
Well, it taught you a lesson or reinforced a lesson because it sounds like you had already taken on, I mean, this level of signaling that you felt you had to do. Look, I'm a jogger. See, sweatband, jogging clothes. In other words, you can't just put on some rags at the end of your bed and just go running. You had to think very deeply about what you were going to look like to prove that this is me running and jogging and not doing something else.
Right. And I think that is something that, you know, almost all African Americans, and in particularly African American males, are taught to do. You know, very early on in the conversation that we began having about the value of Black lives, people began talking about the talk that Black parents give to their Black children. And this talk involves making them understand that when they are moving around in public space in this country, they are perceived differently, that they encounter different and various dangers as a result of being African American. And so, you know, this sort of running and the encounters that you might have doing it as an African American is reflective of, you know, a tradition of oppression and subjugation that we have yet to deal with as a country and a culture.
Martha Foy, you're the running coach with this group. You heard Rendell talking about art and politics involved in running, but there's also running involved. And as a running coach, I wonder sort of what got you involved in this group in the first place?
My interest in getting involved was based on its purpose. The way that it was presented to me was that our visibility was also going to be served as a protest, that we are coming under the umbrella of promoting physical health for our community while simultaneously also thinking about our social and community health. And that was the main reason that I wanted to get involved.
You also, I mean, the idea of this navigating public spaces, I understand that you had a number of encounters, including family members who sort of, as a matter of fact, talked about their being stopped simply because they were African American. And this is something that you internalized. Maybe you had examples of that in your own past.
Well, there's a couple of things that I saw like are very similar. A lot of us, African American male and females, when we are younger, we do have a totally different conversation with our family about how we are supposed to behave when we are in public environments. And what we realize is that none of that has mattered for us. I mean, we're even if we're consciously aware of how we are dressed, how we are speaking to people, how we are our mannerisms and we're conscious, but it hasn't resulted in any change in how we're perceived. And you are right. I mean, I have stories of my own. I remember when I was younger. This is one time I was happy that I was a track runner. I mean, I wasn't actually running. I was actually walking home from a homecoming dance. I was dressed in tights and shoes and a dress that had like lace and. I was talking with a friend of mine, and we started to get harassed by a skinhead group. And I remember having to run through, like, the woods to my house because I didn't know what would happen. And I don't even think I gave them an opportunity to actually get close enough to me to say anything to me. I just realized that there was a danger there. And so I just ran. I ran for, I guess about a half a mile just to get to my home. And I ran all the way up the stairs and locked my door. I mean, I was that alarmed.
I'm talking with Martha Foy and Rendell Smith today on The State of Things. Talking about being African American, running in public spaces. And Martha, of course, there's a health aspect to this. I mean, the idea that you said you were glad you were a track star. These inhibitions, these challenges and barriers to what you know, are not so difficult for white runners. Have health implications. Is that something you think about as a running coach and the health implications of running and exercise?
Absolutely. Without us being physically healthy, we're distracted from being able to do anything within our communities. If we don't believe that we should take the time, an hour or 2 hours out of our day to look at ourselves and how much effort we're putting into eating well, engaging in physical activity, then it's very unlikely that we're going to be available for any discussion about what are the problems that are prevalent in our community.
Yeah, prevalent and, again, very much under the surface in many ways, not evident, particularly if you happen to have the privilege of not having to think about these things. Not always obvious, but Rendell Smith, co-founder of Black Man Running, understand that the running route that you start with in Wilmington is contentious itself. And again, an example of this kind of hidden in plain sight kind of racism. Tell us about Hugh McRae Park.
Okay, so Hugh McRae Park is named for a segregationist in Wilmington. He's also a sort of founding father of the city. In 1913, he donated the land that is now Hugh McRae Park to this city, actually to the county, I'm sorry. And this park was designated for white citizens only. As a way of reclaiming that space for justice and equality, we hold the Black Man Running 5K there, hope to engage people about in a conversation about potentially renaming it.
Talking with Rendell Smith, co-founder of Black Man Running. Our conversation continues in a moment. I also want to thank Martha Foy, the running coach with Black Man Running, who joined us from sister station WHQR. Martha Foy, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Rendell Smith stays with us as our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and today we're talking about the unique challenges African-American men and women face when trying to get healthy. New research shows why people of color may not want to exercise in public spaces and why black women are particularly vulnerable to pressures that might lead to less healthy lifestyles. Rayshawn Ray is a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland in College Park. He specializes in race, class, and gender, and he joins us now. Rayshawn Ray, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
Toni Carey is the co-founder of a group called Black Girls Run, and she joins us now as well. Hello, Toni Carey.
Hi.
And still with us is Rendell Smith, who's co-founder of the Wilmington-based group Black Man Running. Rayshawn Ray, I want to talk with you about your research in a moment, but first give us a sense about the overall health of African Americans. We know there are some disparities. Tell us sort of how healthy communities are now around this United States.
Sure. So, I mean, overall, I think when you look just at Americans in general, I think when we compare ourselves to other developing countries, we see that our health is not as good as others. When it comes to African Americans, it becomes even worse. I mean, we have higher rates of obesity, lower rates of physical activity, and that also comes with higher rates of chronic diseases, diabetes, high blood pressure, the likelihood of strokes. And so when we look at this as a whole, we see that there are issues as it relates to what it means to be black in society, partly because of some of the things that we've heard from Rendell. And it also is coupled with the experiences that we have not only in public space, but at work, the types of neighborhoods that we live in. Most of the neighborhoods that African Americans live in, we oftentimes don't have access to the types of social resources and neighborhood resources that need to be available to actually live healthy and fulfilling lives. Part of that means we have fewer parks, we have fewer gyms, we have fewer healthy eating places. So you put all this together, and I think you said it earlier best, what we actually see is that exercising and being healthy in America is actually a privilege, and that's something that shouldn't be a privilege. Instead, it should be something that everyone should actually be able to take advantage of.
And how do men and women differ, or do they, in African American communities when it comes to these health markers?
So when we look, when we compare black women to black men, what we see is that it depends on the outcome we're looking at. So the work that I've done is primarily focused on middle class blacks and whites. And I focused on that group because we still see health inequalities among blacks and whites, even at the middle class level. So I wanted to know why is a higher social class status, why does having a bachelor's degree or having a good job and making good money or having a home, why do these things not matter as much for the health of African Americans? And one factor I found is that it has to do with the neighborhoods the individuals live in. So, for example, for black men who live in predominantly white neighborhoods, what happens is that they're actually significantly less likely to engage in physical physical activity than if they live in predominantly black neighborhoods. Now, for black women, it's the exact reverse. For black women, we actually see that they are less likely to engage in physical activity in predominantly black neighborhoods. Now, the reason for these factors are different. For black women, it has to do with these with the normal things that we might think about, safety and more so perceptions of safety. So as a sociologist, I'm concerned with perceptions and social psychological measures. And we find that even if a neighborhood is safe, if people perceive that it's not, then that's going to affect the type of activities you're engaging in your neighborhoods. The other thing that women deal with is male dominated spaces. So when you have fewer physical facilities to actually engage in physical activity, say only one park in a neighborhood or one gym, they become male dominated. For black men, they actually face stereotypes and criminalization in predominantly white neighborhoods. And this criminalization means that, as Rendell was just describing, I mean, it's not only people running away, but it's people calling the police. It's people engaging in certain types of activities that actually deter people from engaging in physical activity. So for black men, they then go through a signaling process to try to signal that they belong. They engage in what we call impression management. They wear an alumnus T-shirt from their university. They always carry an ID. They run in places that are well lit. Things that you don't typically think about when you try to engage in exercise. And this leads to them being less likely to engage in physical activity.
Well, Tony Carey, you're a co-founder of Black Girls Run. Tell us a little bit about some of the challenges that you faced when you started running and why you decided to co-found this group.
Yeah, I faced some of the same challenges, actually. I remember going to my first group run in Charlotte, and it was predominantly white, and no one spoke to us when we came. I think someone actually asked if we were in the right place, even though we had running gear on. And so that unwelcoming environment really galvanized Ashley and myself to create our own running group so that everyone there could have a much better and different experience than we had.
What about you heard Rayshawn Ray talking about for African-American women in predominantly black neighborhoods, there's a whole different set of problems. Public spaces dominated perhaps by men, a sense maybe that it's less secure, and perhaps other stereotyping like black women don't run. I mean, how much of that in black neighborhoods do you know about?
Absolutely. I think representation is so important. If you live in a predominantly black neighborhood and you don't see black people running through your neighborhood, then, you know, you never see those images of black people running. And then the same goes with safety or the perception of safety. I think that, you know, I always run with my dogs, for example, or I run with my husband. And so those things are absolutely very relevant. And why I think Black Girls Run has been so successful is because we've created this safe environment for women. You know, group runs, you could have 10, 15 women out there with you. And so you don't have to think about safety. You don't have to think about not seeing someone like yourself. And so we've always just worked to eliminate as many barriers as possible for black women.
When you put out the call for this and decided to start the group, I'm curious to know if there was a surge, if people sort of signed up right away, or if it was a little slow in building as people sort of tried to figure out whether anybody else was going to join.
No, it absolutely was a surge and has been growing and tremendously ever since. I think there was this real need. I think it was a breath of fresh air for people, and really giving black women permission to be out there running, which I don't think has ever happened before. There have absolutely been other running groups prior to ours, dominated by African Americans. But I think ours was the first, again, where you would see all ages, all sizes, all shades, a true representation of what the black female population looks like. And that certainly worked to our advantage.
Rendell Smith, the co-founder of Black Man Running, what was it like for you? And Black Man Running is in and of itself a race, right? It's not necessarily a runner's group, but you've spawned a runner's group as a kind of byproduct of that, right?
Sure. So we have various points of entry. We certainly have the race itself, which took place last year on November 7th, and will take place this in 2017 on March 11th. And folks can go to www.blackmanrunning.com to get information about that. But that's one point of entry. We also have a free movement running group, which meets weekly. We also have a number of artist workshops that we put on that people can come to and sort of find a way into the project through. So all these points do intersect at the 5K event. And, you know, people come together, they run, they walk, they roll together, and they view and present racial justice-themed art pieces and performances.
Is the art, I think you've said that the art is not only sort of an auxiliary part of this, in other words, art that brings people into the group, but also inherent in running itself. You consider it a kind of a public performance piece, am I right?
Right. You know, in the context of Black bodies being surveilled and disciplined constantly, you know, running is a performance. You know, it's also a healthful, sustainable, and regenerative way to inspire change. So we're looking at, you know, using running as a way to bring people together, to get people telling stories, and to essentially sort of educate and form to contradict this centuries-old disinformation campaign that is racism by bringing people together and by informing them and helping them make rational personal and political decisions.
Conversations not only across racial lines but within racial lines. Tony, the name Black Man Running is a political statement, but Black Girls Run also has a kind of political statement. Tell us about the genesis of that name.
Yeah, the name actually came from a conversation with my mom. I had just started running and was sharing with her, you know, I was very excited. And her response was, Black girls don't run, you know, that's something for white girls. And I just took a step back and remember having this that same conversation with Ashley. And we both were like, no, Black girls do run, like we run. And so it was more of a putting our stake in the ground and saying, no, this is something that we can do. There's no reason why we can't take advantage of this sport as well.
And clearly there wasn't, you talked about a surge of membership when people had the chance to do it. So there wasn't much resistance in terms of young women saying, or women of all ages saying, no, we don't run.
You know, I think that there were a lot of Black women already running, and that we were, again, a breath of fresh air for them because they had been out there by themselves for years. And, you know, for the new people who wanted to get into it, it was more of convincing them that it was something for them. They weren't resistant per se, but it definitely was reinforcing that it was something that they could do.
Rayshawn Ray, professor of sociology at the University of Maryland. Let's talk a little bit about internalizing some of these messages. It's one thing to create a group and reclaim these spaces to live healthier lifestyles, but what is it like to go through life internalizing some of these messages without the outlet, without ever raising it to your own consciousness in terms of health outcomes for African Americans?
Well, I think internalizing it definitely becomes an issue, and it becomes important to note as you're laying out is where that internalization comes from. It doesn't come from something that people are just sitting around talking about. Instead, it comes from their experiences of dealing with racialization and discrimination in society. And so when we start there, that becomes important. One of the things that I looked at, particularly among Black women, is why we see these narratives such as Black women don't run or Black people don't run. And one of the things that I found is that although Black women were the group that was most likely to realize and understand the importance of health and exercise, they also bought into narratives such as I'm big boned or I get it from my mom, which as a sociologist, I interpret that to mean, oh, you think that your body is more linked to genetics than it might actually be. So what that means is that you actually buy more into a genetic perspective about physical activity compared to something where you actually have more mastery over your body. What this leads to is then Black women potentially being less likely to engage in physical activity because they don't necessarily think they can change what their body looks like. And I think that becomes important to note that these narratives stem from the way that Black bodies, Black women bodies in particular, have been subjugated and culturally thrown around as being something that that black women just are, not necessarily something that they can actually determine. So that was one of the main factors that we found is that individuals are buying into genetic notions about health. And if you buy into genetic notions, then you don't necessarily think that you can do anything personally to change the way that your body looks.
Well, and again, if you're buying into narratives, genetic narratives, then color is something that you can't change. And if the narrative is, you know, white people have privilege and not so much for people of color, that, again, without raising that to consciousness, becomes something you have to live with.
Yeah, well, I think people lay claims on spaces. How I started this project, I was in Los Angeles where my mother was living, and I would go for a run in the morning. And in the morning times, I would see white kids skateboarding at the skateboarding park. In the afternoon, if I were running in the afternoon, I would see black kids playing basketball. And then on the weekend, I would see Latino kids playing soccer. Now, all of these spaces were clearly defined, and they could have been engaging in these activities at the same time. But instead, it was clear that different racial groups were laying claims on the space at different times, which led to other racial groups perceiving that they couldn't necessarily utilize the space at that particular moment. And I think that's what happens with neighborhoods, is that neighborhoods are so racially segregated that people perceive that claims are laid on a space where other people don't necessarily have the right to use it. And then people say, well, what about gyms? Well, see, this is what we call spillover spaces. If you experience discrimination at a restaurant, you're probably going to be less likely to go back to not just that restaurant, but if it's a chain, all of those restaurants, no matter where you are. So what that means is that if a person experiences discrimination on a public street and there is a gym nearby or a park nearby, they're also perceiving that I'm going to also experience discrimination in those same places. So it leads to people being less likely to engage in physical activity in a larger geographic space than just the specific space where they experience discrimination.
Tony Carey, let me ask you, and then Rendell, I want to ask you the same question, which is these unspoken claims on space, it's free and it's open to everybody, you say verbally, but you recognize that there has been a claim laid on this space. There can be resistance to an effort to reclaim this space, and I wonder if you found that, if in your effort to say, no, this really is our space, you found resistance to it.
Anecdotally, here and there, for example, we had a issue with one of our members running last week. And as she was running, literally someone came out of the blue and called her a racial slur. And so those instances are far and few in between, but they certainly still happen. And now we're having to have a conversation about safety. And so I think that this reclaiming of space, we have gotten pushback about our name and why do you need a group called Black Girls Run? I think that's very uncomfortable for people, but we've been so blessed to be extremely embraced by the running community. We haven't had too many instances.
Rendell?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, the politics of public space and how we govern it, and how we might change those rules is essentially what BMR is all about. And, you know, it's apparent even in terms of like the history of black people and the New World and the United States that right from the beginning, there were very violent restrictions put on where African Americans could go and when. So in Wilmington, you know, we had very clear slave codes that said, you know, you absolutely could not travel without a ticket that, you know, defined, where you were going and who you belonged to. There were regulations, laws that said, if you were a runaway slave, you had to instantly give yourself up, instantly surrender, or else any white person who encountered you had the power of life and death over you. They could execute you without any fear of repercussion. So in that context, we see a continuum where African Americans are communicated with. They're told that there are only certain contexts within which they can engage their communities and public spaces off limits.
Tony Carey, I wonder if you've seen examples of, I mean, once you reclaim the space, it's one thing to say, yeah, I'm healthier and I feel more comfortable running, but also raising to consciousness some of the other barriers that have been internalized. Have you seen changes in the way people sort of understand themselves as a result of being part of this group?
Absolutely. We have those conversations literally every day. I think that it's just a natural progression once you start thinking about your health and what that means to you and your family and generationally. Those other conversations automatically bubble up. And so we are always just trying to empower women and help them realize that we give a lot of power away, and it's okay to take that power back.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Tony Carey is co-founder of Black Girls Run, a nationwide group creating communities of healthy black women. Rayshawn Ray is a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland in College Park. And Rendell Smith is the co-founder of the Wilmington-based group Black Man Running, who joined us from WHQR in Wilmington. I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead on The State of Things, a comic's take on politics and pop culture, a conversation with Paula Poundstone. Stay tuned.